Welcome to Don't Pass Me By with me, Bob Wilson. I have two special guests on today. I think they'll make it a lot of fun. We'll start out with somebody who's been here before, Kevin Baskin. He has the Vintage Baseball Photos page on Facebook. It has over 172,000 members. So, boy, isn't Kevin Mr. Charisma. Our second guest has never been on before. We're lucky to get him today. I'm excited being an Ace fan. We have someone who Sal Bando called amazing. He has more time in with the Oakland A's than Connie Mack. Of course, I speak of Alameda's own Steve Vucinich. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And Kevin, welcome to you as well.
Oh, thanks. It's always my pleasure.
Hey, before we get started, tell us about this hot new vintage baseball photos page that the kids love so much. Who are you, Elvis Presley? 172,000 plus members. Can't be wrong. Tell us about that page.
Well, you're selling me short there, Bob. We've got 173,000 now, but it is growing, continues to grow. So, and we're not exactly the new kid on the block anymore. The group started almost 6 years ago and started out as just a small group of people that had a similar interest that wanted to share old photos and talk about historical things about baseball on Facebook. And it just grew and it started taking off and it just got bigger and bigger. And like I say, now we have 173,000 members and no end of it in sight. We cover really a wide variety of old baseball topics, anything from before the year 2000, we cover within the group. And we have a good time with it. A lot of people enjoy the group and we have a very diverse group of fans of all ages. We like to have the older fans, but we like to have the kids come into the group with supervision, obviously from their parents or grandparents. But we feel like it's a good teaching tool for young new fans of the game to learn about the game's great history.
Well, we love going on the page. I think it's exciting. And every time I go on and see the photos that are up and get in the community on the page, I have so much fun. But I'm going to handle the first part of the interview here, and Kevin's going to be in the bullpen warming up for when I get tired, and he always comes in and saves my game for me because he's all reliable. But the first question I have to ask is, well, let's start out. Steve, please tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us, Steve Vucinich. Well, so first thing that pops into your mind about yourself, sir.
Well, I just completed 54 years with the Oakland A's, 54 plus, because I did work through spring training, the extended spring this past April. And I started out as a ball boy with the A's in 1968, started with the second homestand. I got hired by then equipment manager Al Zeke. And when I went down to talk to him about the job, it was kind of a coincidence. Or uncoincidence, they hired five kids to work in the clubhouse, bat boys, ball boys, clubhouse attendants. And I knew four of the five, although the other four didn't really know each other, but I knew all four. And after opening night, they told me the one that I didn't know had quit. So I went down a couple of days later and started to talk to the equipment manager, like I said, Al Zeke, who had moved over from Kansas City with the A's, and told him I'd be interested. I know the Coliseum, I know the area. I grew up in the area, and Joe DiMaggio was one of the coaches there then. And he said, "Hey kid, what school you go to?" I said, "I go to St. Joe's in Alameda." He says, "Hey, he's a Catholic. You better hire him." And that's a true story. I would have got the job anyway, but it makes for a good story. I've even told that story on Yes TV in New York when we were playing the Yankees, and it's a great story. And so that's how I started. The next year, I became an assistant to the new equipment manager at the ripe old age of 16, and did that until I took over the visiting clubhouse in 1974 at the young age of 21. Nowadays, you have bat boys who are up to 25, 26 years old. So I was pretty young to be in those positions, and I stayed in the visiting clubhouse, but also an assistant on the home side. There were only two full-time of us in the clubhouse then. Now we've got five or six. But, and I travel with the team occasionally. And in 1994, I took over the home clubhouse as equipment manager and home clubhouse manager. So it's been a great ride. I've seen a lot. I'm sure your people have a lot of questions. You get to fire some off, but I've basically seen it all. And everybody says, "Hey, you better write a book." Well, I started talking into a tape recorder a couple of years ago, just when I think of things, and if the tape recorder is close to me, just when I think a lot of the story should be chronicled. And I've told different people, and people have offered to assist me in writing a book. I said, "Well, to make it sell, I'd have to upset a lot of people, but we'll see going down the line how many of these stories are worth repeating and writing about and for a reader to read about them." So I've had a good life. I just turned 70 years old. Still consider myself young and starting to do things during the summer that I normally couldn't do during the summer. I went to Alaska in July, and that was a great trip. You don't want to go to Alaska off season of baseball. So I took advantage of it. So everything's good with me. Thank you.
No, not bad. That's really something. When you went down, I guess you seen Joe DiMaggio before, or was that the first time you got to speak to him? He must have thought something of you to say, "Hey, hire this kid."
Well, you know what? I knew he was there. I didn't know he'd be right around when I was talking to the then equipment manager. I didn't know the layout of the clubhouse as far as coach's room, main clubhouse, hallways, and rooms like that. But I went in and started to talk to Al, and Joe just came right up to be part of the conversation. It was kind of thrilling.
Well, I don't mean to be a boorish oaf, but I have a quick one I'd like to slip in. When I was young, I
Go
worked in
ahead.
a car parking garage, and they told me in a couple of hours, Joe DiMaggio is going to come in a limo. He had been doing commercials for a bank. And they said, "Please just put the car right through." Some of the guys I worked with wouldn't be so nice until you showed your pass, and they would bust your chops, if you're in a limo, to make them wait. They said, "Joe DiMaggio is coming down. Please don't make him wait." And I said, "You guys got it." So I put the limo right through, and I had to escort them to the elevator. And I didn't, I was dying to say, "Hello, Mr. DiMaggio," but I held back. I didn't say anything, and he nodded to me, so I nodded back. And he looked at me as if to say, "Thanks for not going into the fan routine." And then what happened a little bit later that day after he left, a $100 bill came down in an envelope. Had it been signed, I would still have it, but I got $100 from Mr. Joe DiMaggio. So that's the only time I'll bust in with one of my anecdotes today. But we have a page called Fans of the Swingin' Oakland A's Facebook page too. Thanks to my friend Kevin, who gave us a bump. We got some people on there, including yourself. It's a lot of fun. And I asked the guys on the page if they could submit some questions for you because they all seemed to think very highly of you. They got excited and answered me right away. So the first two questions come from page member John Theodore Necht. And he asks of you, Mr. Steve Vucinich, what is your fondest memory from the visiting clubhouse? And then after you've informed us about that, the other hometown clubhouse, what are your two favorite memories that you would pick of your time in the clubhouses?
Well, because he asked about the visiting clubhouse and the 20 years I spent over there, I guess most satisfying and best memory. And I saw a lot. I saw every player in the American League for 20 years. They'd come through my clubhouse. We had the All-Star game there in '87. But two things come to mind. Number one was beating the Dodgers in '74.
Yay.
Because the things that Buckner and a couple popped off, that they made a statement that Reggie would be the only guy that could make their lineup, and we just cleaned their clock, and that was just so satisfying. One of the
Wow.
most disappointing moments was having the Dodgers in the clubhouse, and we were the heavy favorites, and they were banged up, and I saw Kirk Gibson. I was over in the Dodger clubhouse just after game one started, just to converse with their people about when they were coming to Oakland, how big their traveling party was, and the normal routine stuff you do to prepare for a visiting team coming in. And I knew Gibby real well from his days in Detroit, and he could hardly move. He could hardly walk. So, they shot him up pretty well, and for him to limp off the home plate and do what he did and just crush our whole series, really. We never really covered too well from that. But that was probably my most disappointing moment. My favorite moment of the home side, even though I was only an assistant at the time, was in 72 beating the Reds in Cincinnati. It was a great series. Every game was a one-run game except for game six, and that's the game that we got into Cincinnati about 4 o'clock in the morning and had to play a day game. And I'm not using that for an excuse because they did the same thing, but they had a little more momentum going at that time. But beating, you know, I had long hair there. We were the hares versus the squares, and just being a little bit of a, I won't say radical, but a younger 20-year-old kid at the time, to beat the Reds was phenomenal. It was a hares versus the squares, and we loved and relished every moment.
Well, that one, looking of all the ones I've watched in its entirety, that was one of my personal favorites too. You can't beat what happened that year. Since John Theodore Necht asked that question, he only asked your favorite one. But to any other ones, if we don't limit one, come to your mind that stand out that you'd like to tell the fans about?
You know, 75 playoffs, we got swept by the Red Sox. And they celebrated in my clubhouse. I've had quite a few celebrations in the visiting clubhouse, unfortunately. The Reds did it in 90 and the Red Sox in 75. But that was probably one of my more disappointing ones, just to lose. And you kind of knew the A's dynasty was over at that time.
Well, so we wondered, if I'm correct and I'm not having a brain fart, forgive my language, Catfish wasn't there for 75, was he? And if they had him, do you think they would have won?
We could have made a difference. We went into Boston and started two lefties, which was death at that time, both Vida and Holtzman. So, you know, Catfish would have started one of those games and we come away with a split. Now you're coming home for three games. Anything can happen. We, you know, the momentum could have been in our favor. So, yeah, that's a good possibility that we could have continued on if Catfish was there.
Now, you think, from what I understand, a great deal of Catfish Hunter, and I saw a jersey, a picture of a jersey with your name on it and his number 27. I think they should retire your number as well. Why did Catfish stand out so much to you? I think was he one of your favorites?
He was my favorite of all time. Getting to know him. He was just a down-home country boy. They didn't even call him Catfish back in Hertford, North Carolina. They called him Jimmy. Excuse me. And but my third day on the job was his perfect game. And I was down the left field line, saw all 27 outs, saw him get three hits, drive in three of our four runs. And the way he handled himself, and here I am, an impressionable 15-year-old kid, and in awe of what happens, especially when they say, geez, that was the first perfect game in the American League in 46 years. Well, that's a long time. And to know the effect of that game and how Catfish handled himself with the media. And we didn't have the national media there. You didn't have bloggers. You didn't have a lot of people traveling. We had two writers with us, plus a few local guys. There is no television of that game. It was not televised. And just to see how he handled himself, it really impressed me. That was my first impression of him. And getting to know him more over the years, I visited him twice back in Hertford, once while he was still with us and once when he was with the Yankees. And just a gentleman.
Now, when you brought up hunting, I saw a quote by you that mentioned another player who was really something. On the championship years, Paul Lindblad. I understand he was close to Mr. Hunter and that he once carried a dog back 2 miles and he was in great shape. I just lead you along a little bit. Tell us, if I may, ask about Paul Lindblad.
Well, Lindblad and Catfish were really good friends. They're both country boys. Paul is from Chanute, Kansas. He was I think he was part Cherokee or part Native American, whatever tribe, not sure. But they got along because of their hunting prowess, I guess you'd call it. And I heard a story, and I had to ask Paul's son, and it was probably within the last 10 years. And Paul, unfortunately, passed away from Alzheimer's a few years ago. But Paul was always in great shape. He was one of the few guys I ever knew that ran before games, and he'd come back and he'd just sweat. And with every step, you'd see his tennis shoes would just bring sweat out. It's like he'd been in a pool or something wearing shoes. Anyway, supposedly the story is he goes hunting with a bunch of guys. He had moved to Arlington, Texas, fell in love with that when he played down there the 1 year, 1 or 2 years, and stayed there and was a custom home builder. So he went out deer hunting with four or five guys that were in some lodge or somewhere. And they're done for the day. And Paul said, I'm going to go back out again. So he goes back out, takes his dog, and they go out so far. And it turns out the dog just sits. The dog was beat up, tired. And Paul had to carry this hunting dog back the last 2 miles to the lodge. And to know Paul that he could do that and be strong enough to do that, and to figure a dog got too tired, but he was able to be able to help the dog back. It's phenomenal when you think about what kind of guy he was, how strong he was, and what he had to do for that dog.
Well, he does sound like a gentleman and a great physical specimen. Now, the fellas from the page had another question here for you. It's also from what the same member had too, John Theodore Necht. He's been a member in good standing, I would say. And he has a question. It's a little bit dicey, but heck. He said, when the Haas family purchased the A's, is it true that in the clubhouse, I believe, the team had a sing-along? If this is not urban myth, urban legend, were they singing in the clubhouse, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead? Is this true, Mr. Vucinich?
You know, that's the first time I ever heard that. So I'm going to say, if it was true, I wasn't there to witness it. I might have. What happened that day when they made the announcement that he was selling the club to the Haas family, and Roy Eisenhart, who was taking over as president, came down and addressed the club. Everybody was enthused. We got rid of Charlie Finley. We think with local ownership, we will draw better, which was already proven that year with Billy Martin's return. We had almost tripled our attendance from the year before. So everybody was happy. So I wouldn't be surprised if somebody said that and then some reporter picked up on it. But I don't even remember reading about it in the paper the next day. So I think it would have been an apropos thing to do, and I just can't verify that it's happened.
Now, before we get on to the next question, they didn't ask any questions about Mr. Finley. So you were there for all this business. Can you tell us a little bit about Charlie O? He seems to have had a great farm system, but he also seems to have been quite a character and handful. What are your thoughts on Mr. Finley?
Well, when he bought the club in Kansas City, he had a good scouting department, minor league department. And as things moved on into Oakland, he got rid of people. He wanted to cut payroll and things. So we had a skeleton staff the last few years. But Charlie treated me fine. He let me go to the postseason games in L.A. and Cincinnati. And he'd be the kind of guy that, because it's his money, and usually, and I've heard this about Carl Pollard, what he owns, the Twins, or his family does, but the self-made millionaires, and Charlie was no billionaire, but the billionaires even more so, guard their money more than a family inheritance type situation. So Charlie was on top of things, and back then, long-distance phone service was more expensive than it is today, and he'd spend $4 on a phone call to complain about a $6 laundry bill. It made no sense. But he watched the dollars and cents, and you had to watch and be aware that he could call anytime. When he would be flying in town, the front office upstairs, or his secretary and maybe somebody else were trying to keep it a secret, but everybody knew about it. And all of a sudden, the guys in the front office put their ties back on. Things like that. And they were in awe of Charlie. When Charlie was in the stadium, people were watching him all the time just because he was an eccentric owner. He fired all those guys in Kansas City. He fired our managers, our first three managers after 1 year, and then hired Dick Williams, who stayed 3 years, and then Alvin Dart, too. But, he wanted to be involved, and he actually was the official general manager after maybe 4 or 5 years of ownership in Kansas City and did an admirable job. He would go out and scout guys himself or the scouts would inform him this is a guy we should sign, and maybe it was before the draft was incorporated in 65. He signed Catfish, signed Tony La Russa, he signed Blue Moon Odom. All these guys were heralded prospects, and he'd go in there and wow the family. In fact, the Blue Moon thing is a well-documented story that he went to the grocery store and cooked a whole dinner while the family was at his high school graduation, and then come back in and signed Blue Moon to a $75,000 bonus contract. So he was well involved in all of that. And then the draft started. Of course, we had the number one draft choice of all time, which was Rick Monday. I mean, in the same draft, he fell in love with watching Sal Bando at the College World Series. Both were playing for Arizona State at the time. So, I mean, he was well involved. Unfortunately, with free agency, his interest wandered. He didn't think he could compete with the salaries and with big teams like the Yankees. I think what really soured him when the Yankees signed Catfish, who was one of Charlie's favorites, and he just lost Catfish over maybe $20,000. He was supposed to pay $50,000 of his salary, which was one half, which was cheap, into an annuity, and that way he couldn't deduct that as an expense. So they're really arguing over, I heard, $12,000 to $20,000, and that's how he lost Catfish. And I think he could see the era of free agency costing him money, and too much money, and he was going to lose. He was still a businessman. He always said, I wasn't in it to make a lot of money, but I wasn't in it to lose a lot of money either. And he said the only year he ever lost money owning the A's was 1976, and that was the last year before free agency, and he had to pay big contracts to Bando and Tennis, and Holtzman was there. Holtzman had just been traded with Reggie. But there were higher salaries, and they said that's the only year he ever lost money. But he was a successful businessman. You got to hand it to him, tip a hat to him. So, well, and he was okay to work for me. It's well documented how many PR people he went through, ticket office people, because he was hard on those people. But maybe he had more contact with them, and he left us alone in the clubhouse for the most part, because my predecessor, Frank Sinchak, lasted until he retired and lasted all the Charlie family years. I did too. So, and the trainers did too. So he kind of left us alone in baseball operations a little bit more than he would have in the front office.
I guess that was a good thing, but and a perk. But we have another question from page member Rick Hurd. Now, we've already had Sal Bando call you amazing, okay? So we don't want all this to go to your head. No, I'm kidding. You deserve it. But he has a question for you after you've been called amazing already by no less than Sal Bando, the captain. Where did you learn the compassion that has endeared you to so many, asks Rick Hurd.
Well, Rick is a friend of mine. He's a writer for the Contra Costa Times. Are you familiar with that?
This I did not know, as Johnny Carson used to say. Thank you for informing me.
Okay. So anyway, I think Rick has seen me in action in the clubhouse, whether it be the home or the visitor's clubhouse. I always sat back and just observed. And I remember my dad saying one time, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say it. You know, these are proverbs that everybody lives by. But I was just, I won't say I was always amazed. It's just I was always appreciative of where I was and how many people would have loved to have my job. And at that time, there were only 24 of them in the country, maybe Montreal and Toronto, 22 in the U.S., whatever. So I was very appreciative. And the one thing my dad didn't tell me was never do anything you can get fired for. And so I was maybe a little hesitant to engage in conversation with players until they talked to you first. And I thought that was important. I mean, they're coming in and they're only spending 3 days with me, so they're really not getting to know me very well. You know, I got to know other visiting players more deeply over the years as same guys would come in two or three times a season and then just getting to know them better. And so I think that's what it all entails, is that just want to observe. I do that nowadays if I'm in a crowd of I played golf with a bunch of bankers the other day, and it was just fascinating to hear them talk about their business expertise. And just, you learn more by listening.
Well, your dad sounds like a wise guy. You can't go wrong with the proverbs, and he gave you some good advice to boot. You may know our next questions. That person asking the next question, he claims to have been, not claims, I don't mean as if it might not be true, he was a bat boy, I believe, in 1968. Steve Keithley is his name, and he's asked you several memories from the 1968 season. At the old-timers game, he said, I don't want to make the question too long here, I'll get myself confused, but three DiMaggios played the outfield, and something happened with Colonel Sanders that you may remember. I'm trying to hear that one.
Well, the 68, yes, Steve is a friend of mine. He lives up in the Seattle area now. But he just worked that first year in 68. And what they did is they had an old-timers game. Charlie put it together. And because when he came out, he was unfamiliar with the Bay Area baseball history of the Yokes and the Seals in the Pacific Coast League. So he decided to have let's have a reunion. And he brought back so many of the San Francisco. They tried to do the 1948 team. And I think they added players who were around that era. So they brought in all three DiMaggio brothers, Vince, Dom, and of course, Joe, to play in the game, and they kind of highlighted that and promoted that and made for a great day, a great reunion the night before. So many of these Coast League players, a lot of them still lived in the Bay, but a lot of them came in from all over and hadn't seen each other since they'd played together. And God, it was just a real special weekend. I mean, Billy Martin that year started as a coach with the Minnesota Twins, and the Denver was their Triple A team. And so they fired the manager in AAA, and I think they kind of pushed Billy out the door because a lot of the front office in Minnesota didn't like him. They said, go down and manage Denver. Well, he got them in, I think he got them in the playoffs, but he definitely turned that club around. Well, he came out for that reunion. Casey Stengel was there. Casey would always just wear a Mets uniform because he didn't want to wear a Yankee uniform. And, of course, the Mets were the last team that he had managed. But it was a great weekend. Now, getting to the Colonel Sanders reference and Steve's question, Colonel Sanders or Kentucky Fried Chicken was a big sponsor for the A's, and I say big sponsor, it wasn't a lot of money, but they served Kentucky Fried Chicken in the press lounge. It wasn't every day like it was a few years later, but the real Colonel Sanders made a visit to the stadium, and there was a picture that I took that I proudly had on my wall till the day I retired of the real Colonel Sanders, myself, Steve Keithley, who asked this question, and another ball boy by the name of George Nera. And I would find out later, people would say, Colonel Sanders is the second most recognizable person in the world to only Muhammad Ali. And it's kind of cool to have a picture with the real one. And you've had these imposters do commercials in years past. And but it was really cool. I got a picture with the real Colonel Sanders. Very cool.
Now, if you have that, could you post that on our page or on the Vintage Baseball Photos? I'd love to see that.
Well, it's in a collage, and it's wrapped up by the movers because I don't have a place to have it in my house yet. And when I do, I will do that. And if I have I thought I had another copy here. I'll try to find that. Because it's a really cool photo. I mean, geez,
it sounds top of the line to me. I would want to see that. Now, another
photo. I got my picture.
Continue. I'm sorry to be a big old to interrupt you, sir.
No, that's okay. I've had my picture taken with presidents, past presidents, vice presidents, and things, but it's not as cool as Colonel Sanders.
If I had that choice, I would choose the colonel over the president, too. I think that's pretty cool. Now, another fellow before I call on our friend Kevin Baskin to come in. Tony Lavalsidi, you had mentioned Denver. His question was, how close was it when the A's were thinking of moving to Denver in 1979?
It was very, very close. We loaded up the truck, and that was our first year in Scottsdale. And the truck, I referenced the equipment truck, and told them to go to Vegas and call me from Vegas because we might be opening in Denver. So this is like 3, 4 days before opening day, and this would be an unprecedented move that quick when the Seattle Pilots moved to Milwaukee to become the Brewers in 1970. They did it in the middle of springtime, so they had 2, 3 weeks or whatever to work on it. And so I told the truck, and now I had to tell the truck driver, what time do you think you can call me? Because I had to be a certain spot because we had no cell phones back then. So I had, it's all landline stuff. So by the time the next day that he had gone up there and we were told that's a decision to be made, we said Oakland. So I told him, yeah, don't go northeast, go northwest back to Oakland. He called me, and I think I was in a hotel in Mesa, and we opened the season in Oakland. But Charlie Finley, I think it was in 78, came in. We were in Anaheim, and he said, don't rent an apartment in Oakland because the second homestand will probably be playing in Denver. And that would have been even more dramatic trying to move after you played some games in your soon-to-be former home city. So it was a real hectic time. We didn't know who we were dealing with. Marvin Davis was our prospective owner, and he visited with us when we were playing in Palm Springs against the Angels, and said he was looking forward to all of us coming to Denver. So it kind of gave us a sigh of relief that we're going to be hired by the Denver team and stay with the A's because they already had a Triple-A team in place. So you didn't know which people would be staying on. So it was a very nervous time for all of us. As it was like after the 77, 78, and 79 season. And actually, when we hired Billy Martin for the 80 in spring training here, there was still an outside chance we could be going to Denver. And Billy was real popular there and knew a lot of people there. But as soon as they hired Billy, they started selling season tickets. And you could see that the franchise was going to turn around, and that enabled the Haas family to have interest and purchase the club. Following August.
Well, this also, as Johnny Carson said, I did not know. That was quite interesting. But you know what else is quite interesting? That would be Mr. Baseball, Kevin Baskin, the man who has the vintage baseball photos page on Facebook. And I turn it over to his capable hands. I remind you, sir, you're still under oath, even though Kevin is coming out. And at the end, when he's done, there were three other guys from the page who were very loyal. So if you're willing, I'd sneak their questions in at the end. But until then, I hand over to the very capable, intelligent Kevin Baskin.
Kevin, I was
Well,
just
thanks.
going through some stuff in my garage and I found a picture of Bob Uecker and I together and he signed it and he said, Mr. Baseball. So no disrespect to you, but who's Mr. Baseball, you or Bob Uecker?
I'm not going to take that title from Bob Uecker. I don't believe that has ever been bestowed upon me other than by Bob Wilson just in the last few minutes. So no,
Okay.
I won't. Any, I have no delusions of grandeur. But we like I say, we have a little baseball group, and it's grew to be a large portion. But don't have the type of background certainly that you have in baseball and the career that you have. So it's a It's an honor for me to be able to talk with you a little bit this afternoon. One of the things that came to mind that I wanted to ask you about, we'll tell you a little backstory. My wife and I, we've been together for a few years now, and when we first started dating, she told me that she grew up in the Bay Area before she moved back to Arkansas, where we live. But she grew up in the Oakland area and was an Oakland fan back in the 70s at their high point. She was a teenager at the time, and so I thought I'd put her to the test. I thought, well, maybe she was just, pulling my leg, to impress me that she knew baseball. So I just point blank asked her. I said, okay, so you know a lot about baseball. Back in the early 70s, who was the third baseman for the Oakland A's? And she didn't even bat an eye, and she said Sal Bando. And so I knew right then I had a keeper, you know, that she knew her stuff. And so we have a lot of fun going to baseball games and watching baseball on TV. And since I've mentioned Sal Bando, I thought I would ask you, you made a little bit of a reference to him previously, but what are some of the memories that you can share about Sal?
Sal, in 1968, as his first full season in the big leagues, you could tell he was a leader. He was a natural leader. And Charlie bestowed Dick Williams, the captain, label on him. He was the guy that guys went to for advice. He was a leader. And that was evidence when, I mean, Milwaukee signed him as a free agent after that 76 season, not just for that they needed a third baseman. They actually had Don Money at the time. But to also be a leader, and they recognized the fact that he was a leader of 3 championship teams, 5 division championship teams, and he was a natural leader. He could have been a great manager. When he retired, he went into business with John Block, former Milwaukee Buck, and they did small business loans. And then he was talked out of that to come to work as their farm director, and later became general manager for quite a few years. I played golf with Sal during the winter. Unfortunately, he's had a little setback health-wise in April, so he couldn't make it out for the Hall of Fame induction and also the 72 reunion that he would have been a big part of this past season. But like I said, he's a natural leader, a good guy, took care of himself, good family man, had 3 boys. Like I said, just a good all-around guy and a leader. And there are a lot of guys that you get 25 of the guys together and maybe you can spot a guy that's going to be a leader, but it doesn't always happen. And everybody looked up to him, even Reggie, who was the same age as Sal in the same draft. He was best friends with Gene Tennis. And they all looked up to him and talked to him as a leader. And that's what impressed me the most about Sal Bando.
Well, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. Something else I wanted to ask you about, since I have this opportunity today, when I think about the A's of the 70s, I think more than just their championships, but I guess the sadness of when the advent of free agency, the team was broken up, and obviously all ended up with other teams. But in 1976, it was so significant to basically the end of the Oakland A's dynasty when, you know, free agent was right around the corner. And during the middle of the season, Charlie Finley tried to sell Joe Rudy and Raleigh Fingers to the Red Sox. And he also tried to sell Vida Blue to the New York Yankees. And the commissioner voided those deals. And I think they went to their other teams just for a short period, and they were then sent back to the A's. But what was the atmosphere like, where I'm sure it was, you know, people didn't know who was coming or going. What was going on from your perspective when those players were being, one day they're sold, the next day they're coming back to the team? What was that like?
That was an amazing 2 weeks. Unbelievable. So we're playing the Red Sox. The Red Sox are in Oakland. And Charlie Finley couldn't sign those guys. He knew he couldn't afford them. So his thing was he was selling those 2 guys from Rudy and Fingers to Red Sox for $1 million each and Vida to the Yankees for $1.5 million. And he was going to use that $3.5 million to buy free agents at the end of the year. Well, that sounded real good, but I don't think Charlie would have done that. I think that money would have gone right in his pocket. So anyway, the Red Sox are in town. And we hear the rumor something's going on, and then they announce it. And so here's Joe Rudy and Raleigh in the home clubhouse, and they're packing a few things in his bag, basically gloves, cleats, jocks, underwear, things like that, and sending it over to me. So I set them up a couple lockers where they're kind of together, and they come out. And the Red Sox didn't have names on the back of the uniforms then, so it was real easy. They just had to pull out some jerseys, extra jerseys, and you always travel with those, especially for around if you're on the road for around the trading deadline. And so they dressed in uniform, went down the field. Well, Darryl Johnson was the manager of that team. He took him to the World Series the year before, and he had the insight to not play him in a game. Just, you know, if they had joined the Red Sox when they're in Anaheim or Seattle or somewhere else, it wouldn't have been that big a thing. But to walk across the clubhouse, past the elevator, and into my clubhouse, and just, they were still in shock, in awe. And so he had the insight to not play him that day. So the next day, I get a call from Raleigh Finger's wife. And he says, "Is Raleigh there yet?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, we just got a telegram to tell him not to put on the Red Sox uniform." And so Raleigh had just walked in, and somebody had grabbed him outside. I think the commissioner's office had told some A's front office person to come down and grab he and Joe and explain it to them that they're putting the transaction on hold, is the best way to describe it. And so they didn't come into the clubhouse. I think they just hung out. And the next day, the commissioner, Boyd Kuhn, voids the deal, says, "In the best interest of baseball, this is not good." Well, Vida was kind of happy about it because Charlie had coaxed him into signing a 3-year deal just before he announced that. And Vida knew that if he had gone to the Yankees and become a free agent, he would have gotten a lot more money. And Charlie promised him he was staying in Oakland. So that really soured Vida on Charlie Finley, more so than the 72 season did. So anyway, they say, commissioner says, "I'm voiding the deal. Those guys are still with the A's." Well, Charlie Finley files a lawsuit and refuses to play those guys. So now we're going with 22 players the next 10 days. The A's have 22 players. They hadn't played well. It looked like we weren't going to do well that year. We weren't going to be in a pennant race. And so they were dressing out with the A's, taking batting practice and stuff, but they couldn't play in the games. And I can't remember if they even went into the dugout during the games. So in those 12 days, I think we went like 7-5 without them. And only having 22 guys, now you're missing your key reliever, you're missing your left fielder, and you're missing a starting pitcher. And so the players threatened to strike. And now this is big time. One team striking during the middle of the season, I don't think that happened since the turn of the century. And so they threatened to strike, and all this national media came out. I'll never forget, I don't know if you guys know, maybe you're too young, a guy named Hale Heilbrun was with CBS Sports. Keep in mind, there was no ESPN then. There was no cable. There was no CNN. So the national media came out, and they were outside the clubhouse. And Charlie Finley finally relented and said, "Okay, you guys can play. I've been advised it won't hurt my lawsuit against the commissioner." So the first one out of the clubhouse was Joe Rudy. And the first guy down on the field was Joe Rudy. And the fans went nuts. And we actually made a run at the Kansas City Royals. I mean, we were behind them in double figures in mid-August and got hotter than a firecracker. And it came down to the last week of the season. If the season had lasted one more week, we would have caught the Royals. But it made for a great story, a great final days for Rudy, for Bando, for Fingers, for Tennis, for Campanaris. Those guys are all free agents, and we're leaving the A's, and you can tell it was really the end of the dynasty, but we did make a run at the Royals and made it fun. But those 2 weeks were unreal. It just, nothing like that had ever happened in baseball. And like I said, and the one national media guy I remember was Heilbrun. He was a guy with a big mustache. A lot of times he did features on Saturday and Sunday TV for CBS Sports. But an amazing time. I think about that, and that, like the 72 series for me, makes the hair on my arm stand up, really.
Yeah, I do remember seeing him on CBS when I was a kid and doing big stories like that. And the thing in listening to your what you were just talking about, the thing that stuck out, one thing to me that seems like it's pretty amazing that they were able to go 7-5 with a shorthanded roster like that. Like, say, your closer, your your top start, one of your top starting pitchers and your left fielder being out of the line and being able to go 7-5 during that time frame. The team obviously rallied together to try to sort of a us against the world type mentality, I guess.
Or us against Charlie Finley. And it was like that for years. It was like that during his championship years too, because Charlie didn't have to give raises. Arbitration wasn't part of the process yet. So the guys figured their only chance for a raise and getting some decent money was to win a World Series and get a World Series share. So it had always been us or the players against Charlie Finley for years.
Well, aside from the A's players, I know you spent a lot of time working in the visitors clubhouse for a lot of your career prior to doing other things in the organization. Who are some of the visiting players that during your time there that really stick out in your mind, some interesting stories or a favorite player that you could share something with us?
Well, I had a lot of favorite ones, a lot of good guys in the visiting clubhouse. But one of my favorite was probably Dwight Dewey Evans with the Red Sox. I don't know, we just kind of clicked as friends. And even when I would be back in Boston long after he retired, if he was at the ballpark, he always came down to say hi to me. Another class guy, and when you think about how big this guy was in baseball for a long time, was Cal Ripken Jr. And he was one of the favorites of mine. We always sat and talked, and I knew his dad before I even knew him. And then later on got to know Billy a little bit, but Cal Ripken was a favorite of mine, and he's all baseball. I mean, he grew up in the game. His dad was a minor league manager. His brother and him played together, and Cal played his entire career with the Orioles. But just a class individual and a good guy. There are a lot of guys like that. Todd Stottlemyre was like that before he came over to the A's, and I got to know him a little bit after that. So many of the guys. Davey Nelson, got to know him as a player and later as a broadcaster and a coach. Just a fine gentleman, a guy that made an impression on me, as Cal did. Trying to think of some of the others. Al Kaline, Ron Santo. These guys are Hall of Famers. And they had such an aura about them, how they went about their business and how they acted. Such first-class guys. Dick Allen, who had a bad reputation with the Phillies because of his work with Gene Mock, and later came to us and finished his career with us. But he and I became friends and would see each other at the old Equitable old-timer game series that they had just passed away. You talk about somebody I think belongs in the Hall of Fame. It's Dick Allen. Another guy that's overlooked for the Hall of Fame, but I think ended up having about 2,700 hits. One of the nicest guys you ever meet from Oakland was Veda Pinson. I had him in my clubhouse both with Kansas City and the Angels, and what a fine gentleman he was. You heard about what a nice guy he was beforehand, and when you met him, it didn't let you down. Another guy that I only had in the home side later on, but I'd heard great things about, was Mike McFarland, who played a lot of years with Kansas City, 1 year with us, and I think he finished his last two seasons with Seattle. But there have been a great guy. I mean, Roger Clemens was a great guy. Nolan Ryan, very professional, went about his business. He got a great picture of him riding the life cycle after he pitched a no-hitter in Oakland against the A's 1 year. So they're guys that I really respected. Managers I really like. There was a guy named Frank Quillacy who managed the Twins for a while, but I was also very tight with Dick Williams and Chuck Tanner, who managed us for 1 year. Of course, Billy Martin and I were lifetime friends, and so sad that what happened to him, but he would call me all the time, and he actually called me twice before he got hired by the Yankees to let me know. He said, he'd go, "Hey, partner, I don't want you to hear this on the news. I want to tell you I'm coming back to the Yankees," and things like that. Those things mean so much. And again, making the hair on my arm stand up. I hope I didn't go on and bore you with all that.
Oh, no. Thing of it is, both Bob and myself, we're both children of the 70s, grew up where that was our formative years and where we really found the love for baseball. And and we like to talk about those things. And all those players that you mentioned were the people that were my idols and people that I grew up with, collecting their baseball cards and watching on TV and really looking up to. So it's fascinating to hear these stories. And we also have, like I say, in our group, I'm sure in Bob's group, there's a bit of a transitional era into, you know, younger generation people. We've talked so much about the guys that played, and most of the ones you mentioned were the old-time guys that I love hearing about. But who are some of the newer players? I mean, you've been at this for way over 50 years until just this year. Who are some of the guys in just the last few years? I know baseball's so much different now, big money, high salaries, and there may be prima donnas. I'm not going to put you on the spot and say who's the worst prima donna that you've had to deal with, but who are some of the good guys of the game that you've dealt with here in recent years, maybe that are still active players?
Well, first of all, somebody that just retired not too long ago was one of my favorites of all time, and just a great guy, and you never hear anybody say anything bad about him, is Jason Giambi. Now, he's been retired for probably 6-7 years now, but I had to throw him out there. But some of the guys that would be mostly that I've dealt with on my home side, the younger players, Matt Olson, what a fine gentleman he is, a great guy. You're going to see him hit 300 next year, because even though he could hit the ball through the shift, even though he could hit the ball to left field, he's going to get a lot more hits because those one-hoppers to the short right fielder, the second baseman playing out there, aren't going to happen next year. So Matty Olson's an awesome guy. I'm thinking about guys that were with us, and we just traded off a whole bunch. I mean, Chris Bassett was awesome. I love seeing him work his tail off to get to where he was, because he had Tommy John surgery and he had a whole season where he didn't play at all. Guys like him, you appreciate their work effort. Frankie Montes did the same thing. And I'm partial to age right now, just because those were the last players I worked with. Matt Chapman, we're talking about third baseman. We've had some great third basemen in Oakland A's history. Sal Bando, Carney Lansford, Josh Donaldson, Matt Chapman. Matt's the best I ever saw at third base as far as defense. I mean, Josh Donaldson was great. Carney was great. And Sal had that bazooka for an arm. So I got to watch great third baseman. I don't know if you guys, have you seen the new documentary they did on Willie Mays yet?
Not yet.
Okay, you've got to watch it.
Looking forward to it, but I have not watched it yet.
Can I interrupt for one second, fellas? Sure. I had a few questions from the Peanuts Gallery from the guys on the page. So if Kevin goes to the top of the hour, is it okay with you too? Steve agreed if we could go a little over the hour into extra innings, because this is pretty interesting stuff.
No problem at all with me at all. That's fine.
Thank you.
I was mentioning that documentary, and Willie Mays was the best player I ever saw. Now that we're talking about talent, I grew up watching him play. And I watched a lot of his home runs get eaten up by the Candlestick Park wind. Who knows what he would have done? He probably would have been right there with Henry Aaron in the 700s if he played in a more a manageable park like Henry did. But anyway, we were talking about great players. Football players, basketball players, they come out of college after 1 year. A lot of baseball players for the longest time signed out of high school. I think more and more are going to college now. But baseball players have had to mature at an earlier age. They're playing in the low minors at age 18, 19, or out of college at 21. They're not making a lot of money. Maybe they got decent bonuses, but not everybody got them. So they matured younger, I think, than football and basketball players. And I'm lucky to work in a sport where I ran into them. I mean, I was working with them. But I would also see football and basketball players, and it wasn't until football, basketball players weren't mature at the same age as baseball players were. And I kind of made that a point in an article not too long ago, and somebody called me on it, and I said, ask around. And the author got back to me and says, you're right. You get the same answers that I got from everybody else. So I think that's why it was easier for me to deal with visiting players, knowing that, I mean, they were more mature. They'd been through the bushes. They'd been hard knocks. And that the guys that survive are the special ones, not only on talent, but they had to have the mental fortitude to get through all that. And it was very important for them to do that. Some guys just didn't do it. We had a number one draft choice in 1971. We had a choice of taking Frank Tanana or a guy named Bill Sugar Bear Daniels. They were both out of Detroit. And we took Daniels, who was more of an athlete, and he was a great basketball player, too, and he got to be a friend of mine, but he didn't make it. I think he just didn't have the mental capacity to do it and the drive. He got himself a $70,000 bonus, probably thought that was all the money in the world, and didn't realize how good it could have been if he had made it to the top. He was loaned out to the Giants. I'll never forget this story. And the Giants A Club was in Fresno at the time, and Sugar Bear was nearing his end with us, maybe 5-6 years in the minor leagues. And when he moved out, he took all the rental furniture with him and moved out with all the rental furniture. Who does those things? Guys that aren't mature and haven't been taught properly. So anyway, I hate to go on rent on it. If you want to cut that part out, you guys are welcome to do that.
Oh, no, I'm fascinated by all your stories. And one thing I'll kind of wrap my part up and turn it back over to Bob to kind of finish up. But one thing I'd like to say is that I'm certainly appreciative that that you are also a part of Vintage Baseball Photos Group. You've been a member for a year or two, and we're very happy to have you. And I just wanted to let you know that you're certainly welcome to any time that you have any photos, whether it's of Colonel Sanders or of any old players or anything that you ever have, you run across and you have the opportunity that you would like to have a forum to share some of that stuff. One thing that we've really enjoyed is having people who have worked in the game and former players who had, you know, pictures that no one else obviously has seen, because it might have been something that was a casual photo in a dugout or what have you. And anytime that you're able or willing to share any of that stuff, we would certainly love to have it. And I'm sure the membership of our group would certainly like to see any photos that you might have. Thanks again for letting me have the opportunity to talk with you this afternoon, and I'll turn it back over to Bob and let him ask those last few questions.
Okay, well, Kevin, enjoyed it, and I will get some stuff. It's really funny as I was going out cleaning the garage. You know, all the years that I was in Oakland, and my guy said, when are you going to clean out your office? What are you going to do? And I boxed so much of it up and shot it down here to Arizona, and I picked today to I wanted to clean my garage out a little bit, move some boxes around. So I just went through a whole file box of photos all the way back to 68. So I might pick out a few and shoot them your way.
Oh, that'd be great. Bob, anything else you want to ask?
Yes, sir. We had some questions from guys on the from the fans of the Swing and Oakland A's page. I wanted to get in because they're so loyal and they were very interested in sending these over to Steve. But I just wanted to ask one anecdote that I had heard that I thought was kind of funny regarding pitcher Lou Kraus. I was wondering if you could tell us some of the highlights of having Lou Kraus in the locker room, sir.
Back in those days, you weren't allowed to wear Levi's in the stadium, and I was always impressed. He was the best-dressed guy on the Oakland A's. But he had some kind of temper. When he didn't pitch well, or he got taken out of a game where he didn't think he should have, and that was the manager, Bob Kennedy, at that first year, he could come in and destroy anything. But a good guy. When he cooled down, he was a great, great guy. It's just that you knew if he didn't pitch well, you stayed away. He would come into the clubhouse and be nobody there because nobody wanted to deal with him. Nobody knew what he was going to do, how he was going to erupt, what he was going to break, what he was going to throw. But he was a good guy. And I got to, you know, he lived in Kansas City. And when we had Tony La Russa and Joe Rudy was a coach for us 1 year, and Dave Duncan and a couple of the guys that were in that era with Lou Kraus, he always came out and saw us, and he was just a, a good gentleman. He was a successful businessman back in Kansas City. I don't know if you heard the story about, but a few days after graduation, he was signed by Charlie Philly to a $100,000 bonus. Lou Stein was a scout, and I don't know if he even had to give him that much money, but he came out and he pitched a shutout a few days after graduation as an 18-year-old. So, but he was a good guy. Started the first game in Oakland in 1968, and he was a good talent. And he pitched for us, and he went to Milwaukee, and I think he went to Boston and finished with Atlanta. So, a gentleman, even though he could erupt.
Now, speaking of gentlemen, Mike Rudy had come on the show, and he told us some stories of his own college baseball career, and he talked about his dad. Joe Rudy was my favorite player. And I know he was also, to use the word again, a gentleman, a class act. But any stories about Joe Rudy that are we might not have heard, a little off the beaten track about Joe? He was such a great player.
Well, you know what? Joe worked really hard. And I think it's been written, but I don't know if people realize how hard. He was up in 68. we called him up. I think he got called up just before the catcher's 100-perfect game. And then in 69, he was up, got sent down, back up, sent down, back up to stay. And he was not a very good outfielder when he came up. But I think Joe DiMaggio took him under his wing. And Joe will give Joe DiMaggio credit for helping his defense. And he didn't look like a good athlete, but he was. He's a local kid from Modesto, which is 60 miles away. And then in 1970, Charlie Lau was one of our coaches under the then manager, John McNamara. And Charlie worked with Joe, and Joe became a 300 hitter, and the rest is history. But he worked his tail off to become the defensive player he was and also become the hitter. And Joe was kind of a leader, too, like Sal, maybe just a notch below Sal, but very well respected in the clubhouse and all throughout baseball.
I think maybe because he did work so hard and put that in, the fans appreciated that. His head always seemed to be in the game, and he was very clutch. But he was an easy guy to like as a fan. A question came in from another page member, Adam Lurch, and he was asking if you could tell some of the – maybe something you mentioned Billy Martin before, but – he was asking some amusing stories about Billy Martin, if you have any other ones. I know Billy was, you used the word firecracker before. Billy was quite a firecracker, eh?
Well, I got to know Billy as Billy got older and I got older, so I like to think we were both pretty mature. But I would hang with Billy during the winter. We'd be out to lunch or something. And Billy was like the perfect gunfighter that people took aim at. And you always see the stories in the Westerns of some kid, some punk kid, some other young cowboy wants to do a shootout with the what is known as the fastest gun in town. So we would be out, and people maybe didn't like Billy. Most of them loved Billy, especially in the East Bay. But every once in a while we'd be out maybe, I won't say late, 9 o'clock or something. Maybe I picked him up and he flew in from New York or somewhere. And he might stop somewhere and somebody try to pick a fight with him. And it happened more than once. And most of the time, all the time with me, he backed down. And because people knew I was with him, and usually the owner of an establishment, manager of an establishment would want to take care of Billy. Hey, sit over here in a private area type thing. But every once in a while, somebody would come out of the woodwork and would try to pick a fight with Billy. And it was unfair. And maybe if I wasn't there, or maybe a couple of times it happened when he was with the Yankees, when he was with Minnesota, whatever, Detroit, he got in a fight because nobody pulled him away and nobody wanted to. And it was too bad because he got a bad reputation that way. I mean, he was guilty of doing that sometimes, but you never saw that in Oakland. And believe me, it's not because of me, but it's because I think more people accepted him in Oakland and New York than they did in the other places. We had a lot of fun with Billy. He was a good man, broke my heart when he got fired, but I understood it too. It's part of the game, part of the business, and they needed to move on. And Billy had a reputation for, you know, turning a ball club around right away and then fading. And I did not blame Billy for he's gotten a lot of blame for ruining pitchers' arms. We were the first team to have a five-man rotation then, so the pitchers didn't pitch as often. They just pitched a few more innings. And back in those days, and we're only talking about 40 years ago, you didn't work the counts. And the umpires called strikes the way it should be. It wasn't just a six-inch gap around the belt that was a strike zone like it is today. And so that's why I disagree with anybody who says he ruined guys' arms, because he tried to protect them. It's just, you look, you take any five pitchers from that era, and where were they 3 years later? A couple, three of them had broken down, but some of them would come back. So I think it was an unfair criticism of Billy Martin.
Well, it's one thing about Mr. Martin. Everywhere he went, the team, be it the Twin, you know, every team seemed to improve that he touched. And I know managing in New York for George Steinbrenner was no picnic, you know, for when he went over there. But another question. I didn't mean to cut you off about Billy Martin. Certainly, I can't stop an anecdote. The fellas would come after me. What were you going to add on there, sir?
So Billy joined us in 1980. We had lost 108 games. And Billy came in, and his first meeting was, hey, we're going to steal bases. The biggest thing is we're going to play better defense. And, Jesus, our pitcher stood up and clapped because Billy was going to teach him how to play better defense. And we had a young club then. I mean, we had the Dwayne Murphys and Mike Davises and Steve McCaddies and that. But Billy wanted to stress fundamentals and defense. And that got our guys riled up, excited to play. And we've played over 500 that year. And with the interest in the Bay Area baseball, the Giants were kind of knocked down a little notch then. And we were spiking. You got the Haas family interested in saving the A's for Oakland. And then Billy, he knew how to manage. I mean, he took Ricky Henderson under his wing, and I'll never forget, there was a game, an afternoon game, and I forget who we were playing, and Tony Armas was a hitter, and Ricky was on base, and he knew, and Billy had the uncanny ability to pick the right pitch for Ricky to steal. That was usually a breaking ball. He knew when the guy would throw a breaking ball, and he knew that if he threw a breaking ball, it was a situation to throw one, Ricky could steal second easily. Yet, he didn't have Ricky steal because he knew the pitcher would throw a fastball, give the catcher an extra split second to try to catch Ricky if he would steal. But throwing the fastball into Tony Armas, Tony hit a home run, we won the game. So it was 6-1, half dozen of the others. He was just such a smart guy, baseball-wise. And people talked about the funny anecdote, and maybe you guys heard it, some general manager said it wasn't on the field during the game that I worried about Billy. It wasn't the first pitch to the last pitch. It was the last pitch to the first pitch. And kind of a funny anecdote, but he was a great manager, and he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, no doubt.
Well, I agree with you wholeheartedly about the Hall of Fame for Billy Martin. Mark Mundy, a Page member, asks, what are your favorite memories of Bill King and Ray Fosse?
It's funny. We, the Haas family bought Bill King bought the club, and they wanted to make a presence in Oakland. And one of the guys that helped orchestrate the sale was the CEO of Kaiser at the time, a gentleman by the name of Cornell Meyer. So any press conference, any news coming about the Oakland A's, that first winter was held down at the Kaiser Center in downtown Oakland. And Bill King, and we hired Bill King and Lon Simmons, and those were two baseball radio icons, the two most recognizable voices in Bay Area radio or TV history. And these are two guys I grew up listening. I wasn't old enough to realize that Bill King had worked for the Giants when they first came out. But I knew Lon Simmons' voice from both the Giants and the Niners. And then Bill King I really knew from the Warriors and then later the Raiders. So these are two guys that I was in awe of as much as any baseball player I'd ever been around. So they hire him, and then to find out that both Bill and Lon were just down-to-earth gentlemen that would sit there and talk your ears off as long as you talked to them about sports, about anything. And it was amazing to be around those guys for those years. Now, Ray Fosse, I got to know him briefly when he was with the Cleveland Indians, just in my trips between the two clubhouses. But he got traded in 1973 spring training. And after being in Cleveland and losing all those games all those years, he just got this beautiful smile on his face being in Oakland. And he still had that smile on his face after we won the World Series. Just the fact that he was in postseason, he was with the winning club, which he had never been in all his years in Cleveland. And people referred to him as the second best catcher in baseball then, second only to Johnny Bench. So, but I got to be good friends with Ray through the years. We are always connecting. I mean, travel, we'd have dinner together, sometimes on the road, smoke a cigar together on the road or even at home. And he was just a class guy, too. He always came down, sat in my office. What's new today? What's happening? Just a gentleman and I consider a very, very good friend.
Well, I'm going to wax a little bit controversial since we were talking about Ray Fosse. So put your cleats on, sir. No, it's not that big of bad of a question. But one, I think of Ray Fosse, a player, you know, an announcer I loved. I love the A's. What do you make of when that controversial play happened in the All-Star game with Pete Rose? Everybody has their own take on it. Pete Rose was a great player. But that play still makes me wince when I remember seeing that. What do you make of it?
First of all, background. Ray and Pete were good friends, and they were out together the night before with their wives. How about that?
So his good friend took him out and nearly crippled him.
Exactly. That shows you the gamemanship of Pete Rose, the gamemanship. He was out to win, and he won the game because of it. You know, I don't know if it was a dirty play. I think it was part of baseball then. Now it would be considered a dirty play just because of the rule changes. But, I heard Ray talking about it numerous times after. And he always thought, Ray thought, man, this, you know what we're going to do? We're going to get a Miller Lite commercial out of this. And then Pete goes in and gets into trouble that he got in with the gambling situation. But, yeah, I thought at the time it was a hard play. Watching it again and again and again, I still thought it was a clean play because that's what you did back then.
Good answer, fair answer. I heard, I don't know if it's an urban legend, maybe you could clear it up, but I heard that when Pete Rose unfortunately did have his problems, you know, people have problems at different times, we all do, but Pete ended up, you know, over the things that went on, he had to serve some time, and I heard that you know, anecdotally, that in the prison he had to go to, that Ray Fosse's brother was a guard. Naturally, that's a, you know, ba-dum-bump, you know, thing to hear. I was wondering if there was any truth to that or if you knew about that or maybe if it was an urban legend.
You know, I heard the same thing, but Ray was from Marion, Illinois, and I think they've got a big federal prison there. And I don't know if that's where Pete did his time. I just don't know. I mean, I wish I could answer more, but I knew Ray's brother was a guard at the prison there in Marion.
Wow. So
if you can find out if that's where Pete did some time, I'm sure that's the story is true then.
Well, I know that on vintage baseball photos and also on our A's page, a lot of the guys are historians, so I bet we'll get some answers to that. We didn't mention somebody we can't leave out. There were a whole bunch of players who were fantastic, but, Reggie Jackson, love him or hate him, he was a great player, Hall of Famer. He did some things that looked like they came out of the movie shows. I never saw anything like the three homers he hit in the World Series for that other team. He just rose to the occasion. He seemed at times to be bigger than life. I certainly got in some people's bad side at times too, but he's one of my favorite players. What was it like dealing with Reggie Jackson?
Reggie, it's funny, Reggie and I kind of gravitated towards each other, became friends. I made a road trip where Charlie Finney wouldn't pay for my room, which is okay. And I only went just to go. And Reggie says, you stay with me. So we had a 7-day trip to Milwaukee and Minnesota, and I was his roommate. So you can kind of see then, now that was Reggie in his infancy. That was 1971. Obviously going to New York maybe changed him a little bit. Reggie had an ego. There's no doubt about it, but sometimes an ego is just nothing but confidence. And if you're a confident player and you're a confident person, who cares about the ego part as long as you don't hurt other people? It's funny. I heard a story the other day. You know, Reggie now works for the Houston Astros. Did you know that?
Again, I use my favorite Johnny Carson line, sir. Indulge me. This I did not know. How did he end up? Well, in Houston won the World Series. He brings something with him.
Yeah, he's going to get another ring. What happened? And I can you hear me okay right now?
Yes, sir.
My AirPods just went out. So Reggie lives in Carmel, and so does Bob Crane, your owner of the Astros. He has a place there. So he kind of got connected, and we got let go by the Yankees. He got connected, and he's there now. His funny story is one of his first days in Houston, and he's not there all the time. He just makes sporadic trips in. he was walking in, and the security says, "Where's your pass, sir?" And he says, "Do you know who I am?" He says, "No." He says, "I don't. I'm sorry." He says, "Well, I haven't got my credentials yet. I'm October." "Okay, what's your first name?" He goes, "Mister."
That's a good answer.
I thought that was a great story, and it's a true story. But anyway, Reggie, a leader in his own way, but not like Sal or Joe Rudy, those guys. But people always watching Reggie, what he did, and what a talent he was. He told a story in that Willie Mays thing. He was wrong on the ear, but Willie wanted to meet Reggie because he knew Reggie was going to be a great player, and it was Reggie's rookie or second year. But a great talent. He could be – there are days you knew to stay away from Reggie, just like he did with a few other players. But for the most part, because he had to deal with a guy like myself or the coaches or the players or even a lot of some of the media every day, he's more amenable to conversations about things. And maybe when he went to New York, he had a problem with the press. He obviously had a problem with Thurman Munson at the beginning. And Thurman was Mr. Yankee at the time. And so he got off to a bad start there, saying he was the straw that would stir the drink. But I enjoy seeing Reggie now. I think he's become humbled because he's not in the spotlight as much as he was as a player or even as a front office assistant and with the Yankees for those years. But he's become humbled and still a good guy. I mean, I enjoy being around him. I surprised him with some of the stories I remember about him when he was with the A's or even with the Yankees. He said, "You remember that?" I said, "Yeah, but I can't remember what I had for dinner last night, but I remember that." So Reggie was okay. He was Mr. October. I mean, he won that 72 playoffs for us, sliding in and breaking his leg. That was a big part of him. He rose to the occasion. He liked the grand stage. I mean, even years before that, I remember we were finally on national TV against Minnesota in 69. That was the year he hit 47 home runs, and he hit two in that game. In 71, the playoff game against Baltimore, he hit two. There were other national games, televised games, where he rose to the occasion. And it's not like he didn't try it other times. He just had the uncanny ability to do that.
I just, you know, they have movies like The Natural and Robert Redford, you know, I thought did a great job in it, but, you know, portraying special moments, making them almost something, you know, out of this world. But when Reggie Jackson hit three homers in one game, I think it was on three swings, if I'm correct.
You're correct.
You know, obviously swung the bat, but I mean on three pitches. But I never saw anything else like that before, and I haven't seen anything like that since. That was one of the most amazing amazing feats I ever saw in my life, and on such a grand stage. So he really had ice water in his veins, I think.
Well, just watching those games from my home in Oakland at the time, I was so happy for him. And I said,
this is vintage Reggie. He's doing something nobody's ever done before, and only Reggie could do that at that time. And obviously, that was the last game they won the World Series, and three home runs is unprecedented. I think it's been done since, but he steps to the forefront, and I remember watching that game, and I was very happy for him.
Well, Kevin's Mr. Baseball 2, we'll call him. And he knows that I'm a big A's fan, so we got this extra time. Our producer stayed on, and you guys stayed on, which I appreciate so much. If you do have a book, I hope you come back on, and Kevin as well, and we could do this again. But that being said, we have a little time left, so I wanted to kill out this half an hour, which you guys were kind enough to stay on for. So I want to bring up a couple of more players, and maybe next time you come on, we could get some. There's just so many greats to mention in one show. But one guy who stands out is, you used the phrase, the man who stirred the drink, I think Reggie said, with that guy Thurman's ire. But a fellow who stirred the drink in Oakland, I think, was Bert Campanaris. He's a fan favorite, a gamer. He seems like, from a distance, a class act. You know, we don't know these people, but we watch him on TV. But he seems like was a great player. He seems like a good guy. Can you tell us about Bert Campanaris?
He was a real favorite of Charlie because Charlie loved stolen bases. But a lot of people don't realize that Bert Campanaris was signed as a catcher. Can you imagine him being a catcher today? Anyway,
I won't use my Johnny Carson line again, but that's an interesting quote you make there.
But he was a catalyst of that team. There's no doubt about that. He's the one that started the rallies, could steal a base. One year, he didn't hit. He only hit a few home runs. The next year, he hits 22 home runs. People forget about he had a little pop, kind of like Altuve, but maybe Altuve a little bit stronger. Of course, Altuve plays in smaller stadiums than we were playing in those days. So Campanaris was a catalyst. I get on Cappy. He lives here in Scottsdale, so I see him occasionally. And they'll say something to me. I says, gosh darn, Campy, you've been in the United States for 50 years. You can't still speak English good enough? And he laughs at that. And he just still got he still has the Cuban accent is what I mean. And that's fine. But a good guy. Another guy that worked hard and a favorite of Charlie Finley's, sometimes to the point where other players were jealous of his relationship with Charlie. In those days, until arbitration came out, mid-70s, nobody knew what anybody else was making unless you told somebody. So they always thought Campy was making more money than he really was. And some of them were jealous of that. But it didn't bother Campy. He went out and played hard every single day.
Well, and another fellow I wanted to sneak in, he would just come in and, people talk about closers roles changing. You saw a guy like Mariano Rivera with the Yankees later. He'd come in and be lights out for an inning and taking nothing away from him. He was also a great person from what I understand. But a guy with the A's would come in and not just pitch an inning, but pitch like three innings back in the day, which, the kids today wouldn't be used to that from a relief pitcher or closer. Could you tell us about Rolly Fingers?
Well, Rolly came through the system. I think he came up, had a cup of coffee when the team was in Kansas City, and he joined us for good in September of 68. And in 1969, he started a game. It might have been his first major league start, and he threw a shutout. And everybody thought he was going to be a starter then. And then got to the point where he was be so nervous before a game, knowing that he's going to pitch the next day or the day of, and he just couldn't be a starter anymore, so they made him a reliever. And they didn't really have closers. They didn't have stats for saves back then. It was you could come in an 8-0 lead and get three outs in the ninth, and they give you a save. They finally fixed that because I remember Sparky Lyle getting a couple saves with the Red Sox that way. But Rolly would come in. A funny anecdote is he owned the Baltimore Orioles, at least during the regular season. And Earl Weaver would always be yelling in the dugout, come on, we got to score runs before they bring that some big, tall son of a bitch in. And he would close it out. I mean, he'd come in and throw 3 2/3 innings. I mean, look at the stats in postseason with us and doing that. He did give up a home run to Andy Etchebarren, which created a Game 5 in the 73 League Championship Series. But for the most part, he owned the Orioles. and Weaver hated seeing him come in. But he was so different. I mean, that one of the highlights, I love watching the 72 highlights when he strikes out Johnny Bench when he thought they were going to walk him. That was genius by Dick Williams. And not only genius by Dick Williams, but Raleigh still had to throw the pitch. And then you had to hope Johnny Bench doesn't react and think something like that was going to happen. But what an immense talent. Funny thing is, when we lost all those guys, he and Gene Tennis went to San Diego after the 76 season. I would have thought if anybody was going to struggle the most in the National League and one other person would flourish more in the National League, it'd be those two guys. Raleigh went down there with lights out, and Gino had all kinds of problems hitting in the National League for whatever reason. So I knew then that put an end to my scouting days. Raleigh, some kind of guy, he was, you know, nothing bothered him after he became a reliever. Hey, put me in there, and I'll never forget getting the last out of the 74 series. Von Joshua hit a one-hopper to Raleigh, and Raleigh started jumping up and down, and Tennis yelling at him, throw the ball over here, it ain't yet done yet. And it was really funny. But Raleigh's a good guy. I see him all the time, lives in Vegas now. And still a good golfer, and I see him in spring training. He comes around once in a while, so good guy to know, good guy to talk baseball with.
Well, the A's magic was still working even when like Sal Bando and Raleigh ended up in Milwaukee. But I had one more question from a page member, so I don't want to overlook the guys who butter our bread over there on the A's page. And thanks to Kevin for giving that a bump, which really got it going. We have a question from Richard Paloma, and he asks, could you talk a bit about what you think of the relaxed uniform standards going with shoes, sleeves, and socks, and then this endless barrage of alternate uniforms and hats and such?
Boy, we got time for another show.
we want you back on another show. We got 5 minutes now, but okay. When you come back, give us a long version.
You look at team on opening day and back in the, well, before my time, 50s, even in the 60s, 70s, 80s, everybody dressed the same. It's called a uni for one reason. It means one. And all their pants would be the same length. Well, players decided they wanted baggier uniforms. They wanted longer. They didn't want to sew stirrups. They didn't want to wear them. Maybe they thought they were uncomfortable. And that was the evolution of the two-in-one socks, where a stirrup is built in just a single sock. And we were one of the first teams to use that. But so I like the fact that everybody dressing the same. Unfortunately, baseball, the Players Association weren't going to – the players, if they wanted to wear a uniform a certain way, I think Cincinnati and the Yankees were the last ones to enforce some rules. Everybody else just let it go and knew that it wasn't worth – fighting with the Players Association. And if it made the players happy, that's fine. When we had more than one jersey to choose from, I'd go to Tony La Russa the first time, and we had the alternate dark green and we had a white, or we had alternate dark green and gray on the road. He said, let the starting pitcher choose, because he's the one that we need to have him feel most comfortable, most happy in whatever jersey we're going to wear. So I, you know, there are so many jerseys. I mean, the Diamondbacks had 9 different uniforms a few years ago. And you talk about headache for packing on the road, for ordering, for budgeting, for just hanging in the locker. A lot of lockers aren't big enough to have 9 different jerseys and maybe 5 different colors of pants. So I know the city jerseys, they call them the City Connect jerseys, and we'll wear ours in 2024. I don't know why we're one of the last teams to do that. They do so many per year. But some of them are kind of nice as a throwback, some remembrance to the city that they're playing in, and that's why they call them the City Connect. But everybody wearing different color shoes now, that's allowed. I'll never forget a guy named Howard Smith, who was an executive vice president in licensing and with Major League Baseball, came to me and said, what do you think about if players wore bright green shoes, bright orange shoes? I said, well, I'm not in favor of it. He said, but we're trying, and then he tells me we're trying to appeal to the younger kids and let them see those kind of things, and maybe they'll draw their interest in it, because at that time, baseball was, I won't say it was dying, but it was losing viewership and interest. And so that's why they kind of let that go. And that's why they have so many different jerseys, just trying to do interest. We had yellow jerseys, which were real popular with the fans, but the players didn't like them. And then somebody did a research by June, and we had won like 4 games and lost 20 with the yellow jerseys. And that year we shit-canned them for the rest of the year. And people were saying, why not? Why not bring them back? Well, players saw, and they get superstitious too. And they just didn't want to wear that. We had 2 variations of black jerseys. And although more popular with the fans, they weren't popular with the players. And the ownership said, hey, let's keep the players happy. And yeah, as long as fans could still buy those things, it didn't have any real problem with the ownership. But
I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. But yeah, we're running out of time here, but I can't thank Steve Vucinic enough for being on. I hope he comes back. And when you have a book, you have an open door for that. Maybe Mike Rudy would come on with his dad, Joe Rudy, and you. That would be fun. And, of course, it wouldn't be the same without Kevin Baskin. And we thank Steve Roberts for being a great producer. We were talking baseball with 2 great guys here. And we hope you'll see us again next week. And, gentlemen, thank you and good night.